Support for the Commodity Week podcast comes from Strategic Farm Marketing in Champaign, offering crop insurance, grain marketing, and commodity brokerage services. Learn more at sfarmmarketing.com.
This edition of Commodity Week was recorded the 26th day of March.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. You know, since 1988, on and off, I have hosted Commodity Week, and the program you're about to hear is extraordinary. In fact, so much so that you need to hear it all. It's online at willag.org. That's willag.org. I urge you to go there as soon as you're done listening to the beginning of this and hear the rest of the story at willag.org. Our panelists for the program included Dan Zwicker of CGB Enterprises out of Mandeville, Louisiana, Roy Huckabee of the Lynn Group in Chicago, Illinois, Ellen Dearden of AgriView out of Morton, Illinois, and Mike Zuzlow. He is a global commodity analytics and consulting in Atchison, Kansas.
Fine. Son of a gun. Well, I suppose we ought to talk about the markets at some point. Hey, Zuzlow, our tough part here is going to be we won't have the follow-up on the wheat, and this will air over the weekend and tomorrow after the close, but kind of a rough day, Mike, in the wheat pit on Thursday, down 19 cents. You watch this market pretty closely, and I suppose since you're in Kansas, I want to start with you on that one.
Well, it went from the leader to the upside to a Greek tragedy this week. I mean, you went from a 40-cent, roughly a 40-cent high to low going into Thursday's close, and it really did start to impact the rest of the markets. The biggest thing that maybe the trade did not talk about during the week that pertains to the row crops was the idea that with Russia's currency going back up, their inflation is less of a problem, and it's opening the door for them to export more wheat before their June 30th deadline expires on their wheat export tax. And between that and actually selling some wheat to Oman this week, I think it puts the wheat back on the radar screen as a negative variable for the corn instead of a positive variable.
This is because it's low enough price to be feed wheat across the planet?
Yeah, I mean, the first point would be you've got an issue with Russia not wanting to sell their wheat and take it out of the domestic market because their currency was too low and their inflation was too high. Well, that's alleviating itself with the crude oil prices rallying and the dollar correcting, and so now we're starting to get an idea, well, maybe the Black Sea and Russia will be a competitor all over again for the wheat as we head into the springtime. And that obviously translates into the export market for corn, too, and as you say, with the feed grain situation.
How much of a problem do you think it is?
I think it's big from a standpoint of the technicals on the dollar. It looked like a dollar top earlier this week was being put in, but now it looks more like a consolidation because we didn't take out the 95-85 area in the front-end index, and so you could be suggesting on the charts you're consolidating the dollar, getting ready to ramp up for another run to the upside, and that's probably my biggest macro concern as we go into the acreage and stocks report.
And I suppose you could be consolidating and looking to turn down, too.
Yes, but I think at this stage, technically, Todd, you probably need a reason. In other words, you probably need to feed the bear at this point as opposed to the natural path of least resistance may be higher since it's weathered a technical test of the support.
How do things stand on the ports, Dan, and exports for corn, soybeans out of New Orleans?
Well, we're still exporting soybeans. Soybeans still comes in fairly stout. Our corn sales just can't get going with any kind of momentum. It was hopeful that maybe we could maybe sneak in here and get a few more corn sales on the books as we move into spring, but so far that really hasn't happened, and that's where we're at. I mean, the 1.8 billion bushel corn export number I thought was attainable. I guess I'm willing to wait a few more weeks before I say it's not attainable, but we definitely need to see some better numbers than what we're seeing on a weekly basis in here to make that attainable.
Hey, Ellen, I want to ask you about sorghum really quickly. This is a marketplace that we know has been moving fairly quickly over the last year, maybe 18 months. They've ramped up dramatically, but at this point, prior to the acreage report, there's an awful lot of chatter about sorghum, its availability, whether it will replace in areas like Kansas, maybe some of the Delta region, some corn acres. Is it really enough to be considered a viable, I don't want to call it a threat, a viable detail in the acreage figures?
Probably not, because you're only looking on a good year that Milo would grow about 10 million acres. So, you know, it's a minor player. It's a bigger player as you get back into western Kansas and, drier areas. It's certainly a good choice. The difficulty with growing it, even in Illinois, is that not every elevator will handle it. So lack of seed seems to be a big talking point, and probably will be a factor.
Lack of seed and then lack of ability to move it might be a problem on the other end if you don't have the right elevator at the right place.
Right.
Of course, we do use sorghum at Budweiser in St. Louis, and we do have a sorghum market in the state for Illinois and Missouri both. What do you hear Roy Huckabee up at the CME group in Chicago about these kinds of issues?
Well, I think that the basis levels on sorghum is going to have people that's trying to grow sorghum all over just because of the Chinese interest. China's obviously bought more sorghum than the USDA says we're going to export. I think that our sales today went up to about 320 million bushels total, and they're projecting 300. They've raised it the last three S&Ds all on the back of the Chinese buying. And that's because sorghum doesn't have a TRQ in China, and the buyers can buy it at free will. So I think the Chinese imports could be pretty monumental, and because of that, I think that you'll find people who their sorghum acres, I think, will be up 1.5 million over last year, 8.5, 8.6, 8.7, something like that. Not 10, but higher.
What do you think about the corn and soybean acreage?
I think that the fact that corn has gained on beans as much as it has over the last 3 or 4 weeks, we're right back up. The corn-bean spread is back to its highs. And I think that if you poll farmers today, you get a different number than you would have 45 days ago. But I'm stuck in the fact that farmers like to farm, and I don't think any acres lay fallow. And I think that you get an increase in beans and a small reduction in corn, but it's not anything major. Maybe 2 or 3 million more beans and 1 million less corn.
Turn your attention, Ellen, to the grain stocks report for me. I was listening and reading some of what Darrell Good had to say this week about soybeans in particular, and then to some information from last fall when I had some discussions with him that centers on how big that crop actually was, how big usage appears to have been and may be. Are there surprises yet to be found in the grain stocks figures?
Well, I think that there could be. It appears to me that either disappearance is much greater than what we would have expected when you look at the spreads or the basis than what the USDA has been advertising. I think the crop's probably a little overstated. If soybean March 1 soybean stocks come in much lower than 1.3 billion bushel, that would be a market mover, and I think would force USDA to reevaluate the size of the crop.
And we won't know that, of course, until they add it all up at the end of the year. So we'll have to fly blind, I suppose, until we get to September. That's when they normally would be making the changes. And that would be not until the very last day, I think, of September. The 30th day of September is when that final grain stocks number is reported.
Yeah, that could be. There's been times when they have reworked the previous year's production in early in the summer as well.
So basis has been strong. This is kind of odd because we have really big crops for corn and for soybeans. It's pretty clear that they were big one way or the other. But basis has been strong for both of those at this time of year, and that seems, I don't know, it's strong enough that it's just out of place. Does it strike anybody as very odd?
Well, if you look at Central Illinois cash corn, I don't know how anybody can talk bearish corn. I mean, we had a good, strong three-month rally from early October into late December. We settled back into a late January low. We basically went sideways here. And now we're breaking back out of the sideways pattern. And actually, as of Wednesday evening, we were within 11 cents of the cash high for the marketing season. And you hear, you talk to anybody that's in the ethanol industry, processing industry, and they're just pulling their hen's teeth out to get cash corn to keep the plants running. So something is wrong in the corn market. Either, and my guess is we don't have the supply around that USJ says we have. And then the market, as Ray mentioned, is the corn-soybean ratio has been moving toward corn. And, you know, the five-year cycle says it's going to move toward corn for the next year, year and a half, until it gets down to 2-to-1 or 1.8-to-1. So, I mean, the corn market is telling me that there could be some friendly surprises in stocks and acres on that March 31st report.
What if you're only kind of right, and it's really that there's so much storage that farmers look more like elevators, and weak hands aren't as weak as you think they are?
Well, that could be true. I mean, there's been a lot of nice facilities. I mean, some of these farm operators have better facilities than the local elevator does, and I think that trend's going to continue. But the USDA, when they survey the farmer on farm stocks, that isn't going to be as good a number as they think their elevator stocks number is. And I'm not even too sure the elevator number stocks is real right. There's a lot of elevator managers just fill out those forms to get USDA off their back. You know, they take a look at their books and they look at their stories and, well, this is how much stocks I think I have, you know. So I don't. I still think USJ's got a lot of problems with their stocks numbers, and there's going to be a surprise one way or the other in all of these numbers, I think.
Yeah, I was calculating in my head. I think they take, they take more than 80,000 surveys of farmers, and they're all asked about their on-farm storage. They're all asked about their acreage, and they survey more than 9,000 facilities. So let's say they have, I can't imagine they could be off by that much. They have... of the 9,000 facilities, that's a census more than a survey, so they get accurate numbers. It just, that's 90,000 data points. That's a lot of points.
Yeah, garbage in, garbage out, though.
Well, if it's garbage in, then that's a problem. That's a problem. Okay, Roy Huckabee, what do you think about this debate over where things are stored?
If I go to my customer base, and we met with 25 elevators on Friday and Saturday of last week. None of them are worried about supplies. They feel that their corn around them, the space is full. They're worried about holding condition. They're more worried about getting it moved off the farm. We've got free DP all across Illinois, and it's starting to show up in Iowa. And we've got carries in corn. So there's no reason to try to bring corn in to, you know, I mean, it means that they got space to fill. So I've talked out of both sides of my mouth, but my point is that the elevators that I talk to feel that they're going to have a terrible time pulling corn off the farm all year long, and they're worried that when it comes to October of next year, their elevators are going to be still receiving all this corn off the farm, and they're going to be full going into harvest next year, or half full going into harvest next year.
You mean the fall of this year or 2016 next year?
I'm talking about the fall of 2015. I'm talking about the farm space was so empty last year, and prices came down so fast, farmers did not get stuff sold. We thought they sold a lot of beans. And I don't see a lot of beans on farm, but I see an awful lot of corn on farm, and I think we'll be amazed at how big the on-farm storage is in this report next week. I think that's the important numbers, how much is still on the farm compared to how much is in the elevator.
Will it differ regionally, do you suppose? For instance, we knew last year that the guys in the Dakotas were filled up, and their bases broke like a devil because of it. That and they couldn't get trains to move anything.
Well, I see a lot of elevators that are long corn and hoping that the basis will firm as the farmer gets in the field and quits selling stuff. We've had heavy farm selling on this rally in corn for the last, well, since last Friday.
That's bullish.
Okay. The farmer's still got corn for sale.
Yeah, but as long as if it's bullish, I mean, when farmer sells, then that market is hedging that corn into the market price. And, you know, if there's anything I learned sitting down on the floor in ADM in Decatur for 5 years is when farmers sold grain, you just wait a few days and start buying. It'll go higher.
Well, I hate to break this to you, but I think the market participation is a whole lot different than it was when you were sitting in ADM. when 70% of your trade is high-frequency trade and a fund that's got $2 billion trying to find a place to invest it, it doesn't have anything to do with the fundamentals.
Yeah, so let me ask a little bit about that since you bring it up, the algorithms and the black box trading. It used to be that we could say with some great deal of certainty that the fundamentals would bring the marketplace back to where it had to be. And I think in the early parts of the run-up of the marketplace, when they looked back at the commercials versus the hedge funds, that those people got handed their head by the commercials, and that would be your time frame at ADM. Is that right, Dan, that pretty much the commercials handed the heads back to those guys?
The commercials had the grain trade maybe back in the 80s, but, I mean, they slowly begin to lose it as the PC became more and more important into the trading systems. I mean, Richard Dennis started it all with his 250-day moving average systems, and that has all continue to go forward. Now, yes, I agree that the commercials don't have much control in this market like they did have, and all of the money flow is coming from outside of agriculture. But, you know, I get a kick out of everybody's talking about these algorithms. Hell, I've been doing algorithms for 20 years, and I don't know why everybody's all of a sudden talking about algorithms. I mean, all that is
because you didn't have $20 billion that you were doing algorithms with.
Well, that may be so. But, I mean, that's not nothing new. I mean, that's not new at all. I mean, that all of these computer-generated systems are all, you know, certain steps or certain qualifications all of a sudden will turn on that green light or turn on the red light. And you know, you keep fine-tuning it, but that's been going on for years.
Well, I suppose the question really is, does the market represent the right price?
It does. Market knows everything.
Anybody else?
Any given one day, the market knows everything.
The market always knows, and the market represents the right price. Okay, and I suppose everybody will agree with that one. I can't imagine anybody would disagree, at least out loud.
I think the market's more inefficient because they try to think they're pricing in everything at the exact same minute. But if we listen to what Dan and Roy have just been talking about, and what you've pulled out of them, Todd, we have come to a conclusion from what I'm hearing on the other line is that we are trading much more short-term. We're trading much more computers. We're trading less fundamentals, And so in a sense, or I would say even actuality, we are less efficient and more inefficient because we're not trading the medium term, that the supply-demand of fundamentals have taken the back seat, and therefore the market is not right more than it used to be. It's actually wrong more than it used to be.
Let me give you another measure, guys. Go back and pull your basis charts up and tell me how many aberrations you have in basis trade throughout a trading year over the last 2 or 3 years. When the cash will find equilibrium, and the cash will tell you where the market should be. But when corn rallies 60 cents in 5 days, or 30 cents like it has in a very quiet period of time in the last 6 days, your basis levels start to adjust to it. And especially with freight moving around the way it has for the last 2 years, the cash trade has having real headaches managing basis trade and hedges.
And this is because I'm going to take a guess at this, and I don't know, because there is more money, too much money in the market, and the futures trade is so much larger than the cash trade?
Well, it's easy for a guy to sit back and say, I don't understand why the market's doing what it's doing, so it's the funds. I mean, that's an easy excuse, right?
Yeah, I hear that.
But I think it's also important to recognize that in this environment, when a market starts to rally and the money flows into it, it goes further than it should. When a market starts to break and the money flows into it, it goes further than it should. And
but the cash always writes it.
The cash always writes it.
Okay.
It cleanses itself. It just cleanses itself quicker. I mean, information's moving faster. But, I mean, all fall, when this market went up from $1 or from $2.80 until it hit $3.90 there in December, I mean, if I heard one person say it, I've heard a million say, I can't understand why the market's going up because the fundamentals haven't changed. Well, the fundamentals were changing. They did change. We had a smaller crop than what they thought. Our demand is bigger than what they thought. So, I mean, that's part of technical analysis, is to get ahead of the news. If you wait around for the news, you've missed the move.
Do you guys remember the name Jim Wiesmeyer?
Sure.
Oh, sure.
What would you say if I told you we had Jim Wiesmeyers around the market right now? You just don't know it.
He's what?
Well, Jim's gone. But there are people that want the news services to give them headlines now.
Right.
And in the headlines, they want the term up or down or gained or lost, because their computer algorithms takes that and makes a trade-off of it.
Sure.
Right.
They don't want to see the body. They don't want to see the information behind the headlines. They just want to see the headlines. And
right.
Your news services are staffing up to put out headlines, tweets. They're all doing tweets. They're not doing news anymore.
Well, we've had this discussion a couple of times about the
yeah,
tweets.
Yeah, but
the black
I can't say. But what does that have to do with a fair price? That's noise, and there's two sides to every story. And at the end
yeah,
of the day,
absolutely.
We
it
settle
is
out
noise.
Of price.
It's
you're,
noise.
You're
so
very right about that. It
so
is
it's noise.
Noise
and the problem it creates. And maybe Ellen and Mike, you can jump in on this. Is my guess. Is that the problem it creates for you and for your clients are margin calls. Because they have to be able to hold on longer than they used to in the same position, but with a lot more money.
But the benefit is when the money flow comes in and the upside move exceeds expectations, you're going to get a fill on your sell. So the liquidity is a benefit.
Right.
And most times that move swings the pendulum too high, the pendulum too low, because of this huge influx of capital. The commodities market has become a money instrument. It is no different than the equities market. And, you know, when we talk about price, I think you have to say that the cash market is truth, fair, whatever, price, and the futures market is this thing that swings up and down from cash.
Which has always been, but it swings wider now.
Absolutely.
I think it's just the fact that everybody's getting older and they're not as quick on their feet.
I love it.
You know? Well, I'm 65 years old. I was a whole lot different trader at 30.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but the corn market was only moving 3 cents in a month, too.
Yeah, but that felt big back then, though.
Sometimes.
You know, you could afford to make errors when we were looking at modest moves. Now, you know, we can't afford to make errors because the market's going to swing 20 cents.
That makes it difficult, and errors in a couple of different ways. When you make an error, for instance, Ellen or Mike, and I know this never happens, but when you make an error, you're on the hook for it, and it could be pretty deadly pretty fast.
Well, yeah. I think it does say that. I do feel for the small IB out in the country. I do think he's got an uphill fight in a dying market, because I think any farmer, if you truly have a farmer that actually wants to really hedge stuff, he's got to get hooked up with a banker, and you got to do it the right way. But it's really hard. The banker, I mean, my experience is that all sounds good and fine and dandy, and that banker, there's financing it. But then if you get yourself into a big major drought market and you happen to be the drought guy, then the banker, he's sweating and getting cold feet that he's losing his equity in the crop or the land or whatever it is, and then he panics. So, I mean, it's really going to be hard for farmers to market, period, in this time of volatility. It's just real tough. And I think that's why the option market has really picked up a lot of volume. I mean, at least the option market, you know, lets you make a mistake or two and still sell at a higher level if you're trying to protect downside risk. That's what I like about the option market for a farmer is that, you know, here's a price, and if it goes higher, I'm able to take advantage of it, you know.
Okay, so for Roy and for Mike and for Ellen, how have you changed what you do to take to protect your clientele from these swings and to help them take advantage of it? What's changed in the way you think about the marketplace over the last 5 years? Mike?
I would say you're only as good as your clearing firm, and I would say that the small, independent, guaranteed IB that I am, I have come to learn and realize that by being more conservative and thinking through strategies for clients and taking on a more one-on-one approach and less cookie-cutter approach, or try to, that actually helps the producer more than ever in this kind of an environment we're talking about. And, you know, I think a couple things need to be said as a takeaway here. There's two government agencies that determine the corn price. It's the USDA and the Federal Reserve. And that changes in the history of commodity markets. That sometimes the Fed means more, sometimes the USDA means more. But one thing that really struck me last fall that goes to your question, Todd, is what happened in the bean market before harvest. The algorithms, in my view, chose to take the path of the USDA supply-demand numbers and stocks numbers, took the futures lower, and basis went off the charts, $5, $6 over in August and September. I've never seen a market more inefficient in my short career as that in commodities, and it taught me a big lesson, is that they can be as wrong as the dumbest human being out there, because they may, like Dan said, garbage in, garbage out. And I'm not saying the USDA numbers are garbage, but I'm saying they weren't accurate at the time, and the funds and the algorithmic traders ran with them, and they completely disrupted the distinction or the coming together of the futures and cash market for a really important time period. And I was very worried about producers going out and harvesting in the middle of the night and getting in a wreck because they wanted a $4 over basis.
You just got to join us. Well, I think what market advisors are going to have to do is learn how these guys are trading, and Ellen made the quick point is that when these algorithms, all these buys kick in, it's going to surge for a while, and then the advisor has to be able to recognize that and tell the farmer, this is one of these rallies that you need to peel off some inventory.
Well, the farmer is going to have to be very trusting at that point.
Well, right. It's going to be different for the farmer to trade that too, right?
It's very difficult to make those turns with a big farmer marketing base. It's very, very difficult. To answer your question about how I've changed, if you go back a year and a half ago when beans were at $18, wheat was at $16, and corn was at $8, I came to the conclusion that the U.S. farmer did not live in a vacuum, and he was going to be forced to compete with the rest of the world expanding their production over the coming years, and that has proven to be very, very right. My problem was that I told my farm community, you got to liquidate some farm ground because it's going to get really cheap because prices are going to come down. My guy said, I can't sell farm ground because if I sell it, I can't get it back. So you have to protect me. So I've been extremely bearish now for 2 years in the markets. And it's been very difficult to come away from that because I see world stocks very adequate, burdensome in corn, burdensome in beans. And I get into arguments with my staff and the people that I trade with because we're using more corn, so your stocks to use ratio is not nearly as burdensome as what the outright stocks are. And we did take prices down pretty hard. The 325 lows that we made last October are pretty good lows. And every time I get bearish that we're going to go back to them, I have to remind myself that we are down to a third of the price we used to be. So I'm fighting with myself in that manner. But I think that there's a couple of things that I see that bother me even more, and that's that the farm community has missed this market. They have sold very little new crop corn. Most of the customer base that I deal with say that their purchases are less than 10% of what they should be. And I don't know when we fix that. Does a farmer wake up when the corn's chest high and he's got to go sell something and he sells it because he's got corn, not because there's a price? Today, if I look at the revenue stream that's available to a farmer that has any land cost at all, $250, $300 land cost, you're talking about a $40 to $50 bill per acre in profits, and maybe a $75 to $100 bill on beans. That's with 200 bushel corn and 60 bushel beans. And I think it's going to be very difficult for anybody but the best farmer to have much of an income next year. There was a Fed letter, the Chicago Federal Reserve, that put out a credit condition report last month. I'm sure you've all seen it or you've seen something like it. In 2013, they keep a index on loan demand and loan performance. In the beginning of 2013, it was very, very low. At the end of 2014, the loan demand is the second highest it's been since 1990. Their index is 137%. The loan repayment was very high back in January of 2013, and now it's the lowest it's been. It's the second lowest since 1999, 18 years. It's at 69%. Those numbers, when I saw them, I've been saying that the loan issue, the tightening loan supplies for the farm community, were just on marketing, making people market last year's crop before they got a new loan for next year's crop. But I'm wondering if I've missed something here, if there's a deeper chasm in the farm community than what I realize, and that the Fed's showing us that with these loan data numbers. I think the farmer's got a problem in the coming year, maybe the coming 2 years.
Ellen Dearden, how have you changed in the last 5 years?
Oh, man, I try to talk a lot more and explain what it is we're doing and lay things out with clients on exactly what we're doing, so they're not getting blindsided by thinking that prices are going to go up forever, you know, kind of lay things out on the big picture. And then I've tried to be a lot more flexible. I've tried to really try to separate futures from basis on every move that we make, and that's kind of been my way of looking at things, and then overlay the cycles and show people where cycles ought to make big turns, so they know. I mean, who wants to sell in the hole? And if you can avoid selling when these 45-week lows are due or 68-month lows are due, I think you're in much better shape.
Well, thank you all for what I think is truly an extraordinary commodity week. I hope people really enjoy it. And DeRoy and Dan, thanks for being on both ends of the corn market. We haven't solved a problem.
Well, I want to hear Dan's thing about shooting himself with a gun.
I don't think I can let that air. I'm sorry.
That one I think would probably get bleeped. That would probably get bleeped.
All right. Well, thanks so much, guys. I do appreciate it. You have a good weekend, and good luck with the report on Tuesday.
All right. Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye now.
Good night, guys.
Support comes from AgriGold. Celebrating their 12th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's Ag Programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold is at AgriGold.com.